The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 144.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Hey guys, welcome to today's live stream. I'm right here in Phoenix, Arizona, my temporary stop. I've got all situated here in my little office. I've got my globe behind me. That's the world in which we're all going to conquer. That's the end game. That's our goal with our investment strategy. We're going to conquer the world. I want to thank everyone for being right here on the live stream. I can't wait to dive in and answer your questions. Before I do, I want to remind everyone that Gene has that promotion going, a $1 trial for 1 week of the greatest investment subscription newsletter / online forum that exists on the planet Earth today. And that is, of course, Rebel Capitalist Pro. So as soon as we get done with this live stream, make sure you check that out. I'm partnering up with the fantastic, magnificent Lynn Alden and Chris McIntosh. And it's where you can hang out with like-minded people, get better at investing, get some awesome research and some great Q&As, live streams just like this. We've got a lot more planned for that community in the near future. So check that out at georgegammon.com/pro. All right, let's dive into the questions. Guys, I just got done working out. I'm all amped up. I'm going to go hiking tonight at Camelback Mountain. I got a light that you put on your head so you can hike at night, so it's not 150 degrees. All right. Oh, and I even got a car the other day so I can get around Phoenix. I'll let you guys try to guess at what type of car I got. Remember, I'm a car guy. I'll see if anyone can get close in the comment section on what type of car I got for my couple months here in Phoenix. Let's see if I can give you any hints. It's a European car and it's got over 500 horsepower. I'll leave it at that. All right. But you guys aren't here to talk about my car. You're here to talk about some awesome macro questions. And by the way, I just saw that Jeff Snyder came out with an interview with Brent Johnson. So that just hit my iTunes today on Making Sense. So definitely check out that episode. It's got like a cartoon picture of Jeff and Brent on the front of it. I'm going to be listening to that tonight when I go hiking. So I'm super, super excited for that. Okay, first question. Do you think the destruction of supply from deflationary deleveraging, which causes businesses with heavy debt to go bankrupt, will eventually bring on inflation with MMT without needing MMT UBI? Yeah, I do. I think I'd agree with Jeff on that you're talking about a temporary supply shock. Well, maybe a permanent supply shock, but I don't know. As far as prices, I think they'd probably spike and then come back down again because you'd have kind of this battle of demand versus supply. And as supply is going down, demand is going down as well. And it's basically which one's moving down at a faster pace. And if you take your thought experiment to its logical conclusion, yes, you would have supply, but that would create fewer jobs, which would decrease demand unless the government came in with some sort of stimulus. I mean, quite frankly, I think the highest probability outcome of what you're referring to would include UBI and MMT, because I don't think the government would allow that to play out without some sort of stimulus where they're just shooting money directly into the economy, into the back pocket of the average Joe, so they can go out there and spend it with velocity. So I think it's an interesting thought experiment, but I wouldn't say that's my base case, because I see the government stepping in with fiscal deficit spending to try to prevent the demand side of the equation from falling off a cliff like it would in most likely in what you're talking about. But yeah, I mean, I definitely think that we can see increased inflation due to the supply destruction. I just don't know if it would. I don't think that's going to bring on hyperinflation or anything. It well, actually, it could. At an extreme, it could. but I don't think it's gonna. I think that would be kind of like a 1970s type thing. But yeah, great question. Okay, let's see, Michael. Do you think hot war will inevitable with, or maybe is inevitable with China, if the dollar loses reserve status in the past precedes war? Yeah, Bruce Sterling. I mean, you're looking at history, Michael, and if that's any indication, then yeah. I mean, if the U.S. was in jeopardy of losing the reserve status, they probably wouldn't let that go without a fight. Now, there's some very good arguments out there. When I was talking to Snyder the other day about how that would actually benefit the United States if it did not have the world reserve currency, it would be a lot of pain for the first year or so, but longer term, that would be beneficial. It's a strong, strong argument for that. But I don't think the politicians are smart enough to figure that out, nor are the central bankers. And plus, you know, when I talk to Snyder and guys like that, we're just looking at it strictly from an economic standpoint, where the politicians would look at it from a leverage standpoint for other countries and how they can manipulate and control and get other countries to do our bidding. And so I think that from that standpoint, they would be very hesitant to let the reserve currency status go to the point of, you know, maybe a physical war. Hopefully not, but we'll see how it plays out. Question, what are the chances Puerto Rico becomes a state in the next 10 years? I don't know if I would say, I mean, I don't know a lot about it. If I had to guess after being there for the last couple of weeks, maybe 20% or so. But that, that wouldn't void that contract you have. I mean, as far as Act 20 and 22, I think that's kind of what you're aiming towards. I mean, get in and handle it. I mean, if you're making $1 million a year and you're saving $200,000 or $300,000 by doing it, and let's say that, I mean, so it's weird. Most people say, well, if Puerto Rico ever becomes a state, then it's null and void. Okay, fine. Say that's 2 years, or say that's 10 years down the road. That people forget about the savings they'd have between now and then. And also, people have this weird thing where they think that if they move somewhere, that's it. You're done. You only get one move per lifetime. And once you use up that move, you're stuck. And they, you know, they say, well, what if Puerto Rico does, what if Puerto Rico does this? And what do they do? Okay, what if? Then they move and you just enjoy 2 or 3 years on the beach. I mean, just like my buddy Andrew Henderson says with Nomad Capitalists, just go where you're treated best. And if you go to Puerto Rico for a couple of years and they become a state, you're like, okay, well, I just saved $600,000 or $700,000. I'm out. Let's just go somewhere else where they've got a better program. So, you know, I always listen to Doug Casey, and I always liked what he said when he talks about how most people live their life like a vegetable, from the standpoint of they get roots somewhere, and they like they can't move because they've got these roots in the ground, and they're like. You know, I prefer not to live like a vegetable. I prefer more to live like a, you know, like a human being where you just use your brain. And if you don't like what's going on in XYZ place, so you go somewhere else. Like right now in Phoenix is a good example. I didn't plan to come to Phoenix at all. I just, something came up with a family member here in Phoenix and they needed my help for whether it's a couple months or whatever. And so I said, yeah, I'll be there. I need to be there for a few months. We'll be there for a few months. And then if I need to go to Dubai after that with Chris McIntosh, you know, to look at real estate, then I'll do that. I've just never understood this thing with just like roots and you're planted there. And I get it. If you have a family, it's a lot different, but see, even if you have a family, you go somewhere for 3 years and okay, fine. You go somewhere else. I don't know. I mean, I realize you got kids, but I mean, think about how many kids grow up in a military family where they go somewhere else like every single year. And I mean, they turn out all right. So I don't know. You guys have heard me rant on that all day long. But I just wish people would get in the mindset of having a lot more understanding that they have so much more personal freedom than they're allowing themselves. And that you got a lot of freedom. You got a lot of mobility. If you just kind of think it through and allow yourself to be free and not get so fixated on a routine in a specific geographical location. Okay. Let's see. Question. I'm creating a digital product. Can't work out what should charge for it. What should I consider to determine a price? Well, I would just look at like Miles Beckler, my buddy, who's I think the best in the business as far as digital marketing, and see what he's doing, see what type of price points he suggests. But then you just throw it out there. I mean, like Rebel Capitalist Pro is an example. For either the Lynn or the Chris research, that's $57 a month. And for both, it's $97 a month. Now, if we wouldn't have had a good conversion there, you know, you switch up the price. Or maybe if we have too many people or whatever, you know, you just play around with it. It's again, it's like the same thing as being a vegetable. Just because you started at $97 price point doesn't mean that you're committed to it for the next decade. Just play around with it. And if 97 doesn't work, go to 57. If that doesn't work, go to 157. You know, that's the beauty of online marketing and a digital product. You can really mess around with the price point. And, you know, another thing that we're doing, I just met with Gene this weekend. I flew him out to Phoenix so we could meet face to face and strategize. And we decided to, we got a monthly payment plan now, but we're going to add on an annual subscription to where you get a little break on the price to do an annual deal. And you know, it just made sense. So we're going to try it out. And if it works, it works. If it doesn't, it doesn't. So again, that's the beauty of online business is there's a very low barrier of entry from a standpoint of cost. And you can just, you can afford to just throw 10 things up against a wall and see what sticks. Where back in the good old days, or back in the, you know, when I was a kid, or, you know, I'd have to walk a mile of snow every day to work and school, and, you know, think of your grandparents. But no, seriously, back when I was an entrepreneur before I retired, it was all just brick and mortar locations where to try something out, it would cost you $100,000. Now it just costs you $100 or whatever. So use that to your advantage for sure. Okay, question. Any chances the U.S. escapes any blowback from the abuses of the dollar by switching to a cryptocurrency within the next 6 months? Well, I think the chances, the probability of that is very low as far as them switching to a cryptocurrency in the next 6 months. But see, even if they switch to a crypto like the Fed coin or something like that, I don't know that that would... Because the only way, if the U.S., if it's time to pay the fiddler, was what you're saying, the dollar would need to no longer be the reserve currency. I'd say any chance the U.S. escapes any blowback with abuses. And see, what you've got to remember is the dollar is the reserve currency status, not just because it's a green piece of paper, and not necessarily just because it's backed up by the future taxation of the American people. Or the government, which for whatever reason is seen as to where we have rule of law here, which I don't think we have, but that's another argument. But it's not really about this, just the dollar is the world reserve currency just because it's green, or it's really because there's an infrastructure that has been built, a global infrastructure for payments and wiring and processing of funds and the euro dollar system, it's all built on the dollar. So it's not really the dollar that's the linchpin there. It's the ecosystem or the infrastructure. And that's going to be very difficult to change. And even if you had like a Fed coin or something, that infrastructure would probably remain pretty close to the same. The big difference there is that we would all have accounts with the Federal Reserve, just like a primary dealer bank, where they'd be able to monitor every single one of our transactions, and they would be able to deposit bank reserves directly into our accounts that we could use as legal tender, to use Dr. Lacey Hunt's terms. And then they could try to manipulate and control the inflation of consumer prices by inserting and injecting money directly into the economy, and then controlling the velocity at which the money's spent. So I don't know that that's like time to pay the fiddler as far as the U.S. I think that would come once there was a global system that was able to not only replace the dollar, but more so the infrastructure around the global use of the dollar as the reserve currency and just to do business. It's the dollar and English. It's the same thing. You know, English is kind of the language of business wherever you go around the world, and the dollar is the same thing. Tough to change that overnight.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Okay, question. How do you do your whiteboard presentations? Do you practice, use notes, multiple takes? How long do they take to make? They're excellent. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the kind words. How do I make them? Well, I start on my legal pad, and I start with a title of the video, and then what I think the thumbnail might look like, and then I build the three steps around that and how I kind of think of a theme and what I want to talk about, and then I think about how I could best communicate my point. And then I think, okay, well, that's the message I want to communicate. Then how can I do that in three steps? And how can I walk people through like a beginning, middle, and an end? And you know, what's the conclusion of this video? What's the conclusion of my thought? And that's kind of what I like to finish with step number three with. And then I just write it out on my legal pad. And then I like to jot down some notes here. And then I like to figure out how it's going to look up there. And then I put these asterisk things where I want to put in charts. And I'm sitting, so I go through this legal pad, and then I pull up the charts on Google on my computer, and then just get it all in my head. And then, and that's it. And then I just draw it up on the whiteboard right there. And then I've got some lights in here. And then this, I don't know if you can, this thing right here, well, that black thing, that's the tripod. And then my camera's right here. And then I've got this lav mic. So I plug that in, and then that connects right to the camera as far as the audio. And by the way, this is just a cheap camera I bought in Colombia. And I use this not only for the YouTube channel from the beginning, but I also use this to shoot the TV show that we did in Medellin. So don't think you got to spend a lot of money on gear. You don't have to spend a lot at all. And then I'll sit there and I'll press record on the camera right there. And then I'll go up the video and I'll just look in the camera and I'll sometimes I do 4, 5, 6 takes. I just keep saying it until I think I got it right. And then I'll look in the camera and then I'll do a step, and then it gets onto this little SD card, I think this is called. And then I plug that into the computer. And then once I get done with the first step, then I send it to my editors in Colombia, same people that I used to start the channel, same people I used on my TV show that I had in Medellin before I did the YouTube channel. And then I just send them each step, they edit it. And then throughout the day, they continue to send the edits back to me through WhatsApp. And then I approve each step, or sometimes I'll say, no, change this. So I'm like the director as well. And so I sit there and say, no, make this font bigger, make this thing move over here, use this chart instead of that chart. And then when I email them the step, as far as the raw footage, then I email them the charts, And then any video that we use, I tell them the clip that I want to use, and then any pictures. And then that's how we do it. And we go back and forth a couple times with a rough, and then a second draft, then a final draft. And then once we get a final draft, then they upload it. And generally that's about 8 o'clock Eastern time. And then 9 o'clock Eastern time, it goes live. And I sit there and just kind of write out a quick description. Usually I just kind of copy and paste. And that's it. That's the video. It's a whole day process, believe it or not, just to do like a 15 minute video. I know it looks easy and everything, but a lot of people sit there and say, oh, George, it's not that, or, you know, they think that if there's a 15 minute video that it just takes me 15 minutes to do. Like I just stand up in front of a camera, knock it out 15 minutes, and then somehow just it just goes from my camera to YouTube and that's it. And they don't understand that it's like a 12-hour process to do like a 10 or 15 minute video. And that doesn't include the research. Now, as far as the research, and I don't want to go off on too much of a tangent here, but it depends on the video. Like that housing market video, I only did maybe an hour of research because I have most of that in my head. But if I do a video on like bank reserves, like the one I did in St. Bart's, where I was talking about if bank reserves are used as a legal tender to actually buy treasuries at auction and how that might affect inflation, deflation, or liquidity in the system, that video, that took probably 2 weeks of just research to think through. And I was going back and forth on Twitter with Lynn and Brent Johnson and Steve, you know, the Bond King, and they were nice enough to try to help me. You know, we have different opinions on some things, but I was just bouncing ideas off of them nonstop. And so it depends on the video, you know. But anyway, that's enough of that. So you get it. That's how I do the videos. Okay. Next question here. Will Dodd-Frank prevent the next housing? No. Dodd, listen, any type of regulation that comes down from, especially Dodd-Frank, let's be honest. I mean, who were the main two politicians that created the housing bubble in the first place? I'm not going to say, obviously, it wasn't all their fault, but the main two politicians that should shoulder the majority of blame from a political standpoint for the housing bubble in the first place were the two guys that have their name on this bill, Chris Dodd and Barney Frank. those guys were pumping up the housing bubble the whole entire time. I mean, they're on, you can see videos of them on YouTube talking about how there's no housing bubble, that we need to make lending more and lending standards easier and looser. They're talking about that the whole time, going all the way up into 2007. I mean, they're as bad as Krugman. And then sure enough, we give these guys the job, if you want to call it that, the task of making sure the housing collapse or the housing bubble, which they created, and for the most part, to make sure it doesn't happen again. I mean, talk about the arsonist being the firefighter. My goodness gracious. But no, the bottom line is these politicians, they can't, the only thing that they can do with these laws and bills is just create unintended consequences that they can't foresee because they're trying to manipulate a very complex system with billions of transactions on a daily basis. It's very much like trying to control an environment, like the Amazon forest or something like that. You're not going to be able to control a rainforest because there's too many moving parts. It just won't work. You try to do one thing, that creates a chain reaction and a butterfly effect where you make 10 other things 100 times worse just by creating... just trying to fix this one problem and put a Band-Aid over. The economy is the exact same way. So no, that's not going to prevent anything. And if anything, I would say that would create more problems. So it might create the next housing collapse, but it won't prevent it. That's for sure. Now that might be the intention, but like Ron Paul says, or Peter Schiffer, I forgot who said it. And by the way, you know, I think all of you heard that Ron Paul had a minor stroke. I think he's doing fine. So, you know, if you're the type of person that, you know, says prayers, you make sure you keep Ron for sure, Dr. Paul, in your prayers. But I think he's going to be doing great. But you know, they always said, forget the intention of a specific law. usually the end result is the opposite of the actual intention. And I from all the things I've seen, I completely agree with that. Okay, question. Are you suggesting that real estate in California, specifically LA, won't go down in price? A $550,000 home next year or the following year go down by 20-30%? That's a tough thing to unpack, Jonathan, because you've got a lot of moving parts. So number one, if we could somehow determine that the population won't decrease, and I don't think we could determine that because I think the population most likely will, but if somehow the population would not decrease, and if we knew that the government was going to come in with these constant rounds of additional stimulus, I don't see how the prices don't go up, because you just don't have any supply at that price point. Let me be very clear, at that price point. Now, once you get into the $2 million homes where the builders actually can make a profit, so there would be supply coming online, then that's a completely different ballgame. But if you're just talking about the $550,000 home, I don't know how that goes down by 20-30% in nominal terms, in nominal terms. Now, in real terms, it could go down by 20%, you see, because I think inflation could outpace the price appreciation of the actual house, as far as the house just in if you're just looking at the appraisal value on Zillow or something like that. So if inflation is going up at 20% and your house goes up at 10%, your house still went down by 10% in real terms, adjusted for inflation, right? That's what most people forget. I mean, just go back and look at a chart of housing going back to like 1990 and do a chart and then adjust it for inflation, the exact same chart, and you'll see what I'm talking about. So that's very important. So, I don't think it goes down in nominal terms by 20% over the next year. And because interest rates, the Fed's going to peg the yield curve. I mean, they're not going to let rates go up. And if the Fed's buying, and so you got to understand why the mortgage rates are so low. I mean, it's not just because interest rates are low, because a lot of times there's always a delta there on a risk premium. So the banks that issue the loans are going to attach a risk premium to the interest rate. So if they can borrow, or the overnight borrowing, the Fed funds, let's say, is at zero, well, you're not going to get a mortgage for zero, because there has to be a risk premium there. And generally, the risk premium is determined by the marketplace. Well, if the Fed is buying all the mortgages, then the risk premium is going to be a hell of a lot lower than it would be if those banks are just keeping them on their books, or even if they're selling them to Fannie and Freddie. So you're going to see that risk premium compress, because the Fed can buy all, well, they can, or they have shown that they are more than happy to buy all the debt to make sure that asset prices continue to rise. Asset prices, meaning equities and, of course, stock, or of course, housing. So it's a tough thing, man. Now, let's ask another question. Does that mean that I would buy a house in LA? 100% no way, no chance. I wouldn't do that with someone else's money. I mean, there's zero chance. Why? Because it's not cheap. It's wildly expensive. I mean, it's crazy expensive. So just because I think there's, I can sit here and brainstorm and come up with a logical argument for prices going up, that doesn't mean that I want to buy. You see, and that's the moral of the story. That's the punchline. That's the takeaway for everyone, is don't buy something just because you think the price is going up, that should have nothing to do with it. That should be your end point. Your starting point should be just asking yourself if it's cheap or if it's expensive. And if you think the price is going to go up, but it's not cheap, don't buy it. Don't buy it. And you sit there and say, well, George, I might miss out on this gain or that gain. Fine. You miss out on the gain. So what? There's going to be a lot of gains that you miss out on. The key here is not making sure that you capture every gain that you can, that's possible. The key is make sure that over the long run, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, you're playing a game of probabilities. And if you play the game of probabilities well, that although you may get some winners, you'll have some losers, over the long run, you'll come out ahead. But if you sit there and try to chase things that you just think are going up in price because you have FOMO, or you can sit there on a whiteboard and you can draw out why prices might go up, that's a fool's game. And in my opinion, you might make money over the short term. Yeah, your buddies might go in there in the market and buy LA and they might make 10% or 15%, 20% over the next year. But let's see where they are in 10 years. Let's see where they are in 20 years. The probabilities are not on their side. So I just want to make bets where the probabilities are in my favor, because I know that I may lose in the short term. I may lose out on gains or whatever it is, but I don't care, because in the long run, I know that I've got that wind at my back and I'm going to come out ahead. And I think that's the crux of your question, because you're trying to figure out if you think that prices are going to go up, maybe I should buy in LA, or maybe that's an excuse to buy in LA, or, you know, no, not at all. Okay, next question. Your last video predicts that house prices will keep going up due to increase in building costs. Are you suggesting then that there will be no correction? So that's pretty much, I just answered that question. You guys kind of had the same question there. But again, and also you've got to look at the two different markets that I talked about in that video. I'm talking about homes under, like, call it 1,700 square feet. In that video, I think I said 2,000 just to make it easy, but you know, maybe 1,700 feet. If you've got, they're not gonna make any more homes under 1,700 feet. Ain't gonna happen. They can't. Now they might be able to make an apartment or a condo or something like that. But as far as a single family home that's under 1,700 feet, they're not gonna be able to do it. There's no money, there's no profit, unless they want to build it at a loss. And especially in areas like California, you know, you may have a couple areas like Georgia or Indiana or Missouri, Arkansas, a couple places like that, where they might be able to build something around 1,700 feet and get away with it. I mean, the lot would literally be the footprint of the building. You would have no backyard at all. But they might be able to squeeze it out. But in the states like California, Oregon, Washington, New Jersey, New York, Hawaii, the ones that we talked about in that video, there's no way. There's no way. So there's going to be zero supply coming online in the next 20 years. So just now, does that mean that housing prices are definitely going to go up? No, because you could have the population decrease. And like I said in that video, you could also have more people living in the same amount of square footage, which is what we see in South America, what we see in Europe. So that 1,500 square foot house that was built in 1960, that's in a suburb of Los Angeles, where now one family lives, well, in 10 years, maybe two or three families will live in that house. And they'll just, one, each family will have their own little room, and they'll share a family room and a kitchen. So you'll have 10 people living in the same house, paying rent or with the mortgage, that you had maybe three people living in today. I think that's where it goes first. And then if it gets to an extreme there, then I think, but along the way, you're going to see a lot more homelessness. That was really the point of the video, that prepare for just, if you think it's bad now, just wait. And if you live in one of those urban areas, you got to get out. I mean, or at least have a backup plan, right? At least have an RV, for heaven's sakes, that's full of food, that's parked in your driveway. So if the crime rate does skyrocket, and you do have, you know, all these tent cities coming in, that you got your kids, you don't want your kids to be around that. So you got some exit strategy. So if things get bad, you can just hop in the RV and go up to Tahoe or something like that, and just kind of watch it for a couple months from a distance and just see how things play out. I mean, if I had to live in California, that's the first thing I'd do. Is I'd buy a 1990s 7.3 Power Stroke, and I'd buy an RV. And I'd stock it with food, I'd park it in the driveway, just leave it there just in case, And then I try to educate myself to figure out how I could have kind of a longer term exit strategy from there. But that was the point of the video. It's not to say that, I think prices are going up, so you should buy, or really get fixated on the prices. It was more so that there's not going to be any more supply coming online. That's for sure. And if there's no supply coming online, and if the incomes aren't going up, which how are they going up when we have over a 10% unemployment rate? And then, there's no pricing pressure there for wages. So if you don't have those wages going up, and if we see the vacancy rates going down and ownership rates going up, that means less and less housing supply, there's nothing being built. And that means more and more homeless people. And that's exactly what we've seen over the past couple of years. I think it's going to get a heck of a lot worse, especially in those states that I mentioned in the videos in those urban areas. Okay, question, is it a bad idea to invest in gold mines now that China confiscated Kiyosaki's gold mines? I didn't hear about that. I'm supposed to do a couple things with Robert, I think next month. And I reached out to his people the other day to interview him. So I didn't hear about that. I'll have to ask him, can other countries start? I mean, other countries, yeah, they could do that theoretically. I don't know exactly what happened there, but you want to be cognizant. If you're buying a gold mining company, you want to be cognizant of the country where the asset is domiciled, and make sure that they're as business friendly as possible. And that's always the risk. Gold miners go up a lot further than gold, and they go down a lot further than gold for a reason. Because the reason they're leveraged play on gold is because they're a heck of a lot riskier. And I think people that are super bullish on gold just omit the risk involved in owning a miner, because they forget that they're not just owning gold, that they're owning a business, and a business that has a capital structure, and a business that has a management team, and a business that has risk to political jurisdictions, to currencies, to the cost of diesel, as an example. There's a lot of risks that go into a mining company above and beyond just the price of the underlying asset. And I think that most people just look at the underlying asset, they say, oh, I'm bullish, and therefore they just buy the company and think that it's one and the same, and it sure isn't. So make sure you're doing your homework, for sure, guys. And I'll go ahead and just plug Rebel Capitalist Pro. That's one thing that we do there, is that's Chris and Lynn. I mean, that's their profession. They get in the weeds and they determine what mines or what companies have a lot of exposure to political risk and which ones don't. And that's part of what they write in the research. And that's one of the things that we talk about on the live stream. So if you want more information on that, definitely go to georgegammon.com/pro.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
So Chap is asking, do you think it's a good time to invest in rental property in Sacramento right now? I don't know your numbers, Chap. It's all about the RV ratio. It's all about, I mean, listen, just because I think that the housing market in the United States overall is in a bubble doesn't mean that you can't find a good deal. That's the beauty of real estate. It's the inefficiency of the market.
So if you find a super motivated seller, maybe they need liquidity, they need to sell in the next couple of weeks. And I know, I understand this is hard and it's not easy for most people to do, but it is possible. I used to do it and I do it all the time now in Colombia and in Medellin. But you find a motivated seller and you can get a house in 2020 for a 2012 price. And you might say, oh, George, that's crazy talk. No one would ever, why would the seller sell? And listen, you're thinking about it in rational terms. Not everyone's rational, right? I can't tell you how many homes I've bought at the tax auction where the people just let it go to foreclosure with taxes and they owned 100%. They didn't have a mortgage. And let's say they owe $20,000 in property taxes, but the house is a $150,000 house. So how does that even make sense? And it's not like the county, once they foreclose, they just, bam, take it from you. There's like 6 months. They got to put it in the paper and they got to do all these legal proceedings. So you've got a huge timeline, or you've got a big runway where you could make a decision and you could sell the house. So think about that. You've got a $150,000 house and you owe, and there's a $20,000 tax lien on it and you just let it go. What? Like, why on earth wouldn't you sell it? I mean, even if it was a last minute decision, if $150,000 house, put it on Craigslist for heaven's sakes. You can sell that thing to a wholesaler in 3 days. If you put it on Craigslist for, let's say, 130 grand, and sure, you're taking a $20,000 haircut because you're dropping the price, but who cares? It's better than losing the whole thing. So you see, like how could someone do that? But they do. And most often the answer is drugs. And most of those houses that I purchased at the tax foreclosure auction that fell into that category. Now, a lot of them had loans on it, so the people just gave it back to the bank. They didn't care. It was a short sale, something like that. Well, not with, I did short sales, but not with the tax foreclosures. So a lot of them, you know, they just owed so much money and like, screw it, I'm just not going to pay it. I'm going to give it to the county. But some of them fell into that bucket where the homeowner owned 100% of the house. And almost every time it was because they're on drugs. So they're just, their mind is, who knows what they're thinking, you know? So my point is, although we as rational people, we'd say, well, that could never happen. There's no way I could get a house in 2020 for a 2012 price. It can. It can happen. Now it's unlikely, but it's possible. Right. So you got to remember that. So I always want to preface that when I talk about real estate, when people ask me, hey, should I buy a rental property in XYZ town? Well, it depends at what price, you know, what's the RV ratio? I'm assuming you can get a 30-year fixed rate debt or a 30-year fixed rate mortgage. So you've got to be cognizant of that. So just because the U.S. housing market is in a bubble, which I think it is, it doesn't necessarily mean that you shouldn't buy. It all depends on the deal, right? And then you got to look at how low your debt is and what your positive cash flow is. And that's a whole other calculation. So I'm sorry. Hopefully that gave you some insight as to how I think through that stuff, chap. But I just can't really give you a yes or no question without knowing the numbers. I mean, I don't. It would have to be one hell of a deal for me to even consider anything in California. And I don't know that I would. Even if I was able to get that good of a deal, I'd probably flip it. You know, if I was able to get something at a 2012 price right now in California, I'd flip it and pocket the money and then take the equity and move somewhere else where I felt as though there was more tailwind. And that might be out of the country. As far as taking the equity to another real estate market, maybe in the country, maybe outside of the country. Okay, how much do they charge you for your long-term rentals management property, Medi? Just 10%. It's pretty standard. Eric, good to see you, man. Eric Bass is here. I'm sure he's going to be on the live stream with Rebel Capitalist Pro here in about an hour and 15 minutes. Can't wait to see you there, buddy. I'm sure Arthur will be there as well. Oh yeah, there's Arthur. Hey Arthur, good to see you, buddy. I'll see you and Eric on the pro member live stream here soon. Why do some economists say that gold performs well in either inflationary or deflationary environments? Won't gold value fall during deflation? Yeah, but that it might fall less than other assets. So you've got to say compared to what, right? So let's say that you're comparing gold to stocks because you want to hold gold as a store of value and you want to potentially just kind of weather out the storm if you see a bear market coming in stocks. So let's say your gold goes down by 10%, but the stock market goes down by 50%. Yeah, your gold went down. So what? It gained a massive amount of purchasing power relative to what you wanted to buy, which was stocks, right? So just because it goes down doesn't mean that that's a bad thing. If it's going down, obviously it's not optimal, but as long as it's going down less, and I think that's what most of those economists or most of the financial pros that are saying that's probably what they're referring to. But I think you could probably find times throughout history where even in a deflationary cycle, and let's just call it a deleveraging, right? I like to use Chris Cole's term, where we're talking about a deleveraging. Now, is that deleveraging going to be an inflationary deleveraging or a deflationary deleveraging? You're talking about a deflationary deleveraging. I think that there has been times in the past where the price of gold, even in nominal terms or in real terms, might have gone up. I don't know. But I think the more likely scenario is that it just goes down a lot less than everything else that you would want to buy. Okay, question, what's the best source for foreclosures in the US, especially mountain states? I don't know, James, I'm not sure. I mean, there's a lot of companies out there that sell leads, but I think most of them are kind of garbage. Honestly, I think the best thing you can do with that is just drive for dollars. Just drive around your neighborhood or drive around where you want to buy and try to find houses that, or the front yard, they're not taken care of. It doesn't look like someone's lived there, and just kind of do the homework with the info that you can get at the county or the local government and try to maybe cold call them and figure out what's going on. If you're trying to really find a deal in today's market, that's kind of what you got to do. I know, you see those bandit signs. A lot of people think, oh, that's crazy and that's stupid. And a lot of times they're illegal. That's why they call them bandit signs. But man, they work. They really work. So what those bandit signs are is when you're driving around and you see like a corner at an intersection, it'll be like some little, looks like a super cheap sign that just like handwriting that says, I'll buy your house for cash or something. And you're like, who would ever call that? I'll tell you who would call that. The guy that's on drugs that I just talked about, that's got a $150,000 house because he's so whacked out on drugs, he thinks he needs to sell it because he owes the IRS or he owes the county 20 grand. And he's like, oh, and he's freaking out because he's on some sort of drug trip. And he's, who knows what type of paranoia he is. He's like, oh, I got to sell. Right. And those are the types of people that call those crappy looking signs. They work. So, I mean, what I would do is I wouldn't pay for a course or anything unless I was really, unless I knew the dude that was doing it. But I would try to go online and just watch YouTube videos on wholesaling. That's what they call it, wholesaling. And that's where you go and get a property under contract. And then you've got a buyer's list, right? And then you flip the property. You're finding a super motivated seller. You're locking up the deal and you're flipping the deal to an investor like me that would come in and buy it and remodel and keep it in a rental portfolio or go ahead and sell it. So what you'd need to learn is how to wholesale properties. Not that you'd want to do that as a profession or a side hustle, although it might be a good one. It's just really to learn how to find those motivated sellers, which is what we've talked about throughout this live stream. Okay, question. Good books, resources on small business employee hiring management, first IT startup, and I regret that I hired the people I did. Yeah, don't want to step on the same rake. Yeah, it's I don't know. I never read any books on that stuff. I just learned through doing. And you just got to make some mistakes, I think. And the best piece of advice I'd give you is don't hire anyone you can't fire. So don't hire friends, don't hire family members, don't hire anyone that you can't fire immediately. And then I would say probably take a longer time to hire someone and then fire someone faster. Most people do it the opposite. Most people hire people right away and then it takes them a long time to fire them. And then that person just, it doesn't do any, you feel bad, so you don't want to fire them. You're doing a disservice to both parties because you're taking your time and energy out to train the person and you're wasting their time because although you might be paying them, they're not, this gig isn't a good fit for them. So the faster you can fire them when you know that that's inevitable, the better it is for both parties. And so I've gotten to the point where, I mean, I'll fire someone in 2 or 3 days just because once you start seeing a certain amount of red flags, it's like, it's not going to work. And as an example, if someone's there for the first week and it's their very first week and they're late, like 4 of the 5 days, trust me, I don't care how good their excuse is, it ain't going to work. It's not. Yeah. Or if I hire someone as an example, and like if I hired someone as an assistant, let's say, and let's say after the second day, we're on a phone call or whatever, and I'm trying to tell them to do X something, and they're like trying to tell me how to run a YouTube channel, or they're like, I don't know why you're using those thumbnails with the big heads. I don't know. I don't like that. I don't think you should use those thumbnails with the big heads like that. I think you're turning off viewers. Yeah, okay. You're out. This is not going to work out for you. Now, that's not to say that I'm not open to constructive criticism, but you got someone that's an assistant and this is your second day on the job. And I've got a YouTube channel that I grew with and grew up to 185,000 subscribers within a little over a year. And you're sitting there telling me that you don't like my thumbnails? No, this isn't going to work. you need to be somewhere else, right? So it's just those red flags. And now that I've been doing this so long and I've hired so many people over the years, you just build up that sixth sense to where you can see those red flags just instantly, where maybe other people might not see them as quickly. So anyway, but just through trial and error, and I wish I could just give you like a magic book that tells you how to do it. But I don't think there is one. If there is, I don't know of one. I just did it through trial and error. And I was fortunate in the sense that one of the first businesses that I managed had a call center. So there was a lot of turnover anyway. And so that built up my skill set to hire and fire people and do it the right way. So long term, it could be as productive as possible. Let's see. Question. I'm thinking about starting a trucking company and running a truck I buy. All right. Yeah. I mean, I was talking to Chris the other day, and I think if you guys want a business idea that I think would be awesome, security. I think security is going to be a huge, huge business in the United States over the next 10 years or so. So private security. So we get these riots, we get these quote unquote protests, whatever you want to call them, and you live in a specific neighborhood and you live at the end of the cul-de-sac. Nope. You hire a security team, or let's say everyone on your cul-de-sac hires a security team and you've just got a security guard out there. Just at the front, you got kids playing out there and you don't want to deal with it. And if social unrest gets worse and worse and worse, which I think it will, especially in the states that we talked about earlier, and you have to stay in that state because of your job or whatever, what are you going to do? You're going to hire a private security guard. So I think that's a fantastic business. And I also think that, private data is going to be a great business, meaning to keep your personal data secured away from Google and away from governments. And if we go to a Fed coin, and your bank account is now with the Federal Reserve, and they can see every single transaction. You know, obviously none of us want that, but it does present a great opportunity for a business to come in and create some sort of system. I don't know what it would be, but some sort of a way to keep your personal data private from the government or from the Federal Reserve, or make it like encrypted or something like that, so the Fed can't see exactly what you're doing. I mean, and who knows where it'll go, but it's, as far as Big Brother in the United States, it's only gonna get worse. And so I think that's a great opportunity for a business, an entrepreneur, to come in and try to do their best to solve the problem. So as far as personal data and keeping it private, and personal security, private security, I think those are going to be great businesses in the U.S. Let's see. So what do you think of Steve Van Meter's view on inflation? I mean, Steve's a smart guy. Steve's a super smart guy. I don't know that. I think where I see things a little different is in the interpretation of the Federal Reserve Act. And in the sections that I've read, is, I think, just right at the top of my head, 14, I've read quite a few sections, but the main sections that I got focused on were 14 and 16. I didn't, when I read it, and I read it many, many times, I didn't interpret it the same way. And I'm not saying I'm right. I just had a little bit different interpretation. And I see the Fed coming in and looking at Japan and looking at Europe and seeing how they failed, if you want to call it that, to create consumer price inflation. And I think they know what went wrong. And I think they're going to try to solve it by turning bank reserves into legal tender. So I think, you know, Steve is, if the system stays the same, and I think that's Steve's argument, I think that's Brent's argument, and I think that's Dr. Lacey Hunt's argument, that if the system stays the same as it is today, then yeah, we might get deflation, or maybe disinflation, where it's just this grind lower and lower, like the Japanification thing. I just don't think the system's going to stay the same. And then so that's kind of where I differ. And then the way the Federal Reserve Act is written, I kind of have a little bit different read on it. But listen, Steve's a great guy. Steve's a lot smarter than I am. And I really enjoy talking to him. And I really enjoy listening and seeing his, you know, his content on YouTube and Twitter. And I can't wait to interview him again and see what he's saying and dive into his research further. So he's got great content. I've got a huge amount of respect for him. And I think I'm just really honored to be in a position where I can have conversations with guys like Steve and Brent and Jeff and Chris McIntosh and gals like Danielle DiMartino Booth and Lynn Alden and all these people that that I just think are fantastic. Klaus Schwab. By the way, I don't know if you guys saw this, but I had some people in the UK that subscribe to the channel tell me that the BBC did a, I don't know if you want to call it a hit piece or whatever, where they talk about the internet being full of misinformation and how you've really got to watch and be careful what you watch on the internet, because you could be watching a YouTube channel that could give you all of this misinformation and mislead you into believing all of these crazy conspiracy theories. And they actually used my channel as an example of misinformation on the internet. And you know which video they used as an example, oddly enough, is the video that I did on the Great Reset. Remember the World Economic Forum, that video I did with Klaus and where they want to do this Great Reset. And I read straight from their website, and I took their YouTube videos that they produced. And I pretty much said, hey, look, they're planning this Great Reset. And here's the plan. Here's what they're doing. I think it's crazy. I think it's sinister. I think we should be concerned about the central planning. But the BBC used that as what you should look out for, and that I'm pushing all of this misinformation, and that I don't know what I'm talking about, and you should you know, beware of these channels like George Gammon. And I just think that the irony is that every single thing in that video was straight from the World Economic Forum's own website. And it's just so outrageous that the BBC probably thought that I was making it up without going to the World Economic Forum's website and checking it out for themselves. But anyway, they threw me under the bus. And it's just, you know, typical media stuff that they just don't know what the heck they're talking about. And it's ironic, isn't it, that that the people they say are throwing out all the fake news and the misinformation when they themselves are the ones that are misinforming all of their viewers. But I was going to do a response video to that when it comes out on YouTube. I don't think it's out on YouTube yet. So when it comes out, I'll do like a response video so you guys can check it out. And I'll just slam him like he deserved to be slammed. We'll get the BBC. That's right. All right, guys. So I think that's going to do it. Yep, we're just over an hour here. So thanks a lot for staying on to the end. I want to remind everyone to check out Rebel Capitalist Pro at GeorgeGammon.com/pro. That is the online forum I have with a lot of quality information backed up by data charts and my good friends Lynn Alden and Chris McIntosh. So check that out at GeorgeGammon.com/pro. And I want to give out some shout outs to everyone that stayed on till the end. We've got Math Guy, Mary Chang, Arthur Martinez. We'll see you in about an hour, Arthur. We've got Abe Porter, David, Total Recall, NG Hermit, Dickie Dunn, Sue C, Klaus Schwab. There he is, Klaus. Damn you, Klaus. You got me in trouble with the BBC. Klaus, you need to call the BBC. And actually, they're probably doing your bidding for you. That's probably what's happening. The BBC is probably just an extension of the World Economic Forum. How's that for a conspiracy theory, BBC? There you go. Bill, thanks for hanging out. Eric, Christina Montejo, Hunter, Total Recall, Mary Chang, Edward, Simon, Isaac, Hosey, Dan, Charlie, Andrew, Jim. I get them all? Mentatus? Is that? Hopefully I'm saying that. All right. John, Vinny, Lama Lakiyama, Brendan, Andrew, Ryan, Angelo, Abe, Bond, James Bond, and Robert. All right, guys, have a good one, and I will see you on the next video.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at GeorgeGammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.